The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you award-winning trade and working capital funding solutions that allow you to build a business that dares to disrupt. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
So different look and feel for The Money Show this evening, and I think you're going to like it because it is in part paying tribute to the remarkable brain and contribution made by a man called Daniel Kahneman, who I'd be surprised if you weren't at least familiar with the name. Most famous for his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, but deeply respected around the world as one of the key fathers, I suppose, for want of a better word, of behavioral economics and helping us understand human nature and our economic decisions. We've got some really brilliant people on tonight to explain it to you and to explain his contribution and why his contribution matters. And then later on, in the second half hour of the show, you're going to get Kaya Sitole on. Kaya's a bright guy, chartered accountant, political analyst, and you would have heard Wayne Devanagian, Eyewitness News, of course, celebrating the fact that e-tolls are discontinued. Brilliant. Absolutely great. But the money's being spent, and it still has to get paid, be paid for. Our response to the way in which government imposed e-tolls was one of saying, no, we don't think so. And so instead of a user pays principle, everybody's going to have to now pay. So that's going to be really important. Because our behavior has led to an economic outcome which is going to have an impact on all of us. So we'll talk about that this evening, as well as Michael Fridgen. Now, Michael Fridgen, you know, is a lovely man. He knows a thing or two about wine. And he and I share, one, a love of wine, and two, an outrage at the markups that you see on wine lists, the psychology of the wine list and how to navigate it this Easter weekend. We'll try and save you some money and embarrassment. Save you embarrassment, which is more important, frankly, when you're trying to impress somebody. The Money Show brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Very few people get to change our understanding of the world, help it make more sense in a way that we can comprehend. One of those people was Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist and Nobel Prize winner for his work on behavioral economics, who died yesterday at the age of 90. Dion Goos is the chief investment officer at Credo. He's on the line to us from London this evening. And Dion, I mean, Daniel Kahneman, other than being an extraordinary intellect and obviously a brilliant academic, did fundamentally shift our understanding of our relationship with money and economics, didn't he?
He certainly did, Bruce. Before he and his friend sort of alerted us to the principles of behavioral economics, you know, there was this belief in finance that you could explain things in the form of formulas and algebra. And all those were typically based on all sorts of assumptions which were ultimately flawed. And it took people like Kahneman and Tversky and Richard Taylor, they're all peers and friends, those who are still alive, to bring our understanding back to the fact that it's ultimately a human issue and not a mathematical issue. And I think that changed perspectives and you know, meant a lot to market participants like myself.
What did you learn? What did he teach you? Because I mean, you are somebody who has a mathematical brain. You have an analytical brain. This was telling you that you were, you know, not wrong in what you were, your calculations, but you perhaps may have been thinking very differently about human, you needed to think differently about human nature and the way we respond to risk, to financial outcomes.
Yes, I think my own training, you know, I'm an accountant, and I think a lot of people in the market are either accountants, in some cases actuaries, certainly some sort of mathematical kind of quantitative grounding. But when you work in the market, you see that things are imprecise, that ultimately market participants are not rational like, you know, the original finance academics assumed we were. We are human. You know, we suffer from greed and fear. We get overexcited. We get depressed. And that's why bubbles form and crashes happen. And a lot of time, these things cannot really be explained mathematically. But certainly, from an emotional point of view and a psychological point of view, they can. And I guess I saw these things before I came across my first book in behavioral finance, which was the late 90s. And I'm actually going to quote one of the principles that he espoused, which is the one of confirmation bias. All of a sudden, there were people writing in very clear, articulate, down-to-earth language about the kind of things that I'd experienced. And I immediately took to it. And it was quite comfortable to identify with it, you know, at that point in time and learn from these masters who had done all these experiments and came up with these concepts and principles, which ultimately, I think, add so much value to an investment mindset.
Because we believed up until a point, probably till Kahneman started publishing his research, that as rational beings, we're fully in control of our decision-making. And he essentially proved that we certainly are not rational when it comes to economic decisions. We are conflicted. We have a series of belief systems that come from our upbringing, our education, our society, the media we consume. All of these things affect our understanding of the world, and if something goes contrary to that, we get a little bit jittery.
Yeah, very much so. You know, there's this concept that people talk about, it's called physics envy. The typical economics or finance professional and the typical economics and finance academic suffers from physics envy, because in physics there are laws of nature that have been, you know, discovered and proven and written down, and they work, and we know that we can prove mathematically, you know, if X happens and it, you know, impact a certain force on Y, you know what the outcome is, how far it will travel, how quickly it will, you know, accelerate or decelerate. That's what happens in physics. And in finance, it doesn't work like that. And to come back to your point about being rational, as mentioned before, we're not rational. We all think we're rational. We try to be rational, but we're not. We are human, and we suffer from mood swings, and ultimately, you know, that informs a lot of our, you know, foibles.
It doesn't just affect us in our personal lives. It doesn't just affect us as to whether or not we invest, how we invest, where we invest, or how much we invest. Surely this has then got to be extrapolated, because as humans, we are what makes up companies. We are what makes up boards. We are what makes up governments. We are what makes up societies. And all of these factors then filter into every single aspect of our lives. People don't necessarily make the smartest economic choices for them when they're standing in a ballot box. They're making an emotional choice. They're making a choice based on history. They're making a choice based on what their parents did or didn't do. They're making a choice based on their life experience. When they stand there, they're not necessarily saying, who's got the best ideas? Who's going to be better for my future, my children's future? They're kind of going on what we used to call gut instinct.
Absolutely. And in fact, the way you've just phrased it, you know, reminds of one of the acronyms that he writes about in Thinking Fast and Slow. I'm not going to pronounce this well, but it's something like Vidyati. What it stands for is what you see is all there is. And what he means by that is that we're all a function of our reference frameworks. You know, I don't want to talk politics tonight. That's not what the show is about. But speaking for myself as an Afrikaner of a certain age, having grown up in Johannesburg, you know, being subject to the Afrikaans schooling system, to the NG Kerk, to the Nasionale Party politicians at the time, to teachers and dominees and parents and friends and the SABC, I should add, all of us telling us the same story. You know, it's little wonder that it took so long for people, I think, to see the light, ultimately, in terms of the political reform that, you know, was required. Because all we knew, all we saw was what we experienced around us. And that ultimately, you know, it's not much of an excuse 30 or 40 years later, but still, it is. I think it does explain people's behaviors and their biases and the way they behaved up to a point.
And again, it feeds into the social media environment in which we live. There's a fabulous quote. The lunch with the Financial Times is my favorite part of the Financial Times, not because of the lunch, but because of the conversations that I had over lunch. He had lunch with the Financial Times, and he said, people prefer their sources of information to be highly correlated. The messages you get that are consistent with each other and make you comfortable. We like to mix with people who think like us. We like to socialize with them. We like to work with them. We like them to confirm what we think about the world. And then we think we're geniuses because everybody around us thinks the way we do. So we must be right. And that is what comes down to a concept that I think we're becoming more and more familiar with, and that is those intrinsic biases we have that we don't even necessarily appreciate that we have.
Absolutely. You know, that's the whole concept of confirmation bias, and that is why something like diversity, broadly defined, diversity across gender and race lines and demographics, is so important, because you get these different opinions and these different contributions, which sometimes will challenge your own sort of comfort zone. But that's ultimately how you discover better and more optimal solutions over time.
Dion Goos, thank you very, very much for joining us this evening. The Chief Investment Officer at Credo in London, somebody whose life and career has been impacted by the work of the late Daniel Kahneman. Ian Mann is our regular book reviewer. He's the Managing Director at Gateway's Business Consultants, and I happen to know for a fact that he has read the work of Daniel Kahneman. He would have absorbed the work of Daniel Kahneman. He would have ingested the work of Daniel Kahneman, and he would have applied the work of Daniel Kahneman in his everyday life. And I have no doubt, although I shall have to test this with him, that it would be one of his best business books, I think, of all time, even though it's written by a psychologist, because it helps us understand why we think and behave the way we do. That's what we're going to talk to Ian Mann about in just a moment. And we're going to apply then what we're talking about this evening with Dion Goos in London and Ian Mann in Johannesburg, all about that when it comes to making decisions on things like e-tolls, things like buying wine on a wine list. Ian Mann, the regular book reviewer and managing director of Gateway's Business Consultants. I'm assuming that this Daniel Kahneman's seminal work, and that is Thinking Fast and Slow, has got to be, if not in your top three, your top five of books that you've ever read. Am I making a big assumption, a dangerous assumption, a wrong assumption here, Ian Mann?
Not at all. What he does in this book is explains to us how people think. And
my biggest assumption, I fear, that I'm making is that Ian Mann is audible. I'm not sure where Ian is, and because it's the Easter long weekend, he's very kindly agreed to talk to us this evening. I fear that his signal may not be optimal. That is worrying me just a little bit. Not a great line, my producers tell me. You know what? I am grateful that you've pointed that out, because I couldn't hear him either. So we'll try and get him on a slightly better line. We will send him up to the top of a hill. There is no mountain high enough for him not to climb. My producers are chasing him around. And let's talk about demographics briefly, because I came across a really interesting statistic today. And if you've ever wondered what the fuss is around this concept of demographics, this should help explain it. There's a Japanese nappy maker becoming the latest to announce that it will stop producing them for babies, and it is going to focus exclusively on making nappies for adults. Birth rates in Japan, you see, are at a record low. Japan has got a rapidly aging population. So this company, OG Holdings, says it's following the trend, which has seen sales of adult nappies outpace those of infants in the country for more than a decade. In fact, there were 5% fewer babies born in Japan in 2023 than in 2022, just 758,000. The lowest number since records began at the start of the 19th century. And at its peak, Japan registered more than 2 million births a year in the 1970s. So birth rates have plummeted. Birth rates have plummeted. It's not new. Unicharm is the country's biggest nappy maker. In 2011, it noticed this trend. And it may be tempting to think that falling birth rates are a good thing, a boon for a creaking planet. There are 8 billion of us. It'd be good to have fewer people on the planet. But it's disastrous economically, because you've got fewer and fewer people entering the workforce and supporting a growing elderly population. China's seen its population shrink for a second consecutive year. They're also trying to boost birth rates. But there are also populations declining in Hong Kong, in Singapore, in Taiwan. And the world's fastest population decline is actually happening in South Korea, which is interesting. Southeast Asia, big changes coming through there. But so much so that companies that make products aimed at babies are shifting their focus to the other end, well, the other end of the market, that is.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
To Ian Mann, who we hope has got a great cell phone signal. I was saying to you earlier, I'm not sure if you heard, Ian Mann, that I would assume that this, if not your top three books, is certainly in your top five. Is my assumption correct?
Up there at the top. I think that the book is incredibly profound. The fact that a man who's a psychologist, an academic psychologist, gets Nobel Prize in economics is in itself a fascinating idea. But the why it's important, and I think why he got it, his Nobel Prize in economics, is because he's focusing on how we think. And until Kahneman and Tversky, we thought that Homo economicus was how we should understand man. Man is rational, and he wants to get as much as he possibly can for as little effort as he puts in. All his economic decisions are all rational decisions. He'll rather have two loaves of bread for the price of one rather than pay twice as much. And what Kahneman proved was that human beings are not rational. And why this is terribly important, because your thinking ability controls everything. Controls your judgment or about yourself, about your family, but also judgments that your doctor makes about you and your investment advisor makes about you. If we don't get a handle on what, and this is what he brought to humanity, if we don't get a handle on how human beings genuinely think, we're going to make some very, very serious mistakes. And it's not simply a question of if you know more information and you think more clearly, you'll come up with good results. No, you won't. He talks about thinking slow and thinking fast. It's his system one and system two. System one is we think automatically about things. Like if I said to you bread and, you probably would say bread and butter. And we drive around in our cars without applying our minds very much. That's how our mind works automatically and very, very quickly. Very little effort, and we have very little control on how that works. For example, if you look at a word, you can't turn your mind off and not read it. Your mind reads it. System two, which is his slow system, is where we deal with more complex things. For example, if you said 17 times 24, which is 408, but you have to think about that one or actually work it out for yourself. But our system two is awake all the time, but very low intensity. And we're kind of like lazy about thinking deeply about things. And because of that, and because we can't avoid that, it affects the way we do absolutely everything. If we just talk about, example about voting, we're all going to be voting soon. Voting that takes place in a school building, let's say, proved this in Arizona, where the issue that they were voting on was more money for schools. If the voting poll was in the school itself, people voted for increasing funding more than they did in the rest of Arizona where they weren't actually in schools. We think that it affects all parts of our lives, including our intelligence and our investments. I think the investment one is probably the most important one right now for people we're talking to.
No, absolutely. But I want to put a hypothesis to you, which I'm going to test with the political analyst Kai Sitole this evening, as to whether or not it was rational for us to push back against e-tolls. Because our immediate response to e-tolls was, hell no, we won't pay. Yes. Because we didn't like the way the government had imposed it. We didn't like the tariffs. We thought it was unfair. And we thought they were trying to pull a fast one, which I think they were. So there was a rebellion against e-tolls. A decade and a bit later, they've been abandoned. But the money is spent and has to be repaid. Now, all of us are going to have to repay that money. So I wonder, using Kahneman's philosophy, whether or not we made a rational choice or an emotional choice. Did we think fast? We certainly, I don't think, thought slow about it.
I think we thought rather fast. It's a very good example because we didn't think about what you're telling us, what you're telling everybody right now. We human beings are guided by their best interests. So yes, I'll always choose not to pay if I don't have to. And I think this issue of being honest and should you be is wonderful. He talks about an experiment that they did in the university staff from in Britain, because you'll see from the numbers. What they did is they have an honesty system for the academic staff. And you have to pay so many cents for this and so many cents for your sugar and pence for your sugar and so on. They put up a picture of flowers for a couple of weeks. This experiment lasted 10 weeks. And the next week they switched this from picture of flowers to picture of just people's eyes. And then back to flowers and then back to people's eyes. Just a person's eyes. The when there were eyes showing, people paid 70 pence. That was their, and the same people paid 15 pence when they only saw flowers. So it wasn't that they thought somebody was watching them, but we are so subliminally affected by the stuff that we tend to respond to that without even knowing we're responding to it. I tell you one other thing which I think is quite fascinating.
Sure.
If you loaned somebody 100 rand or 1,000 rand, And they came up to you and they said to you, I know I owe you R1,000, I've got the money, but hey, how about this? Let's go double or quits. If we'll flip a coin. If you get the heads, you'll get R2,000. If you get tails, we forget the debt. If you're the lender, in all the experiments he did, he says, no, I'll take the 1,000 because I know that that's mine and that's, I'm not taking any risks. When you're the borrower, you're prepared to give up your, it could be R2,000 that's given, but you're prepared to put, you're prepared to hand over to chance that maybe you won't have to. Now that is a nice, cute experiment. It's quite nice to know. But if you have a look at investors, when an investor has a stop loss and a price take, they always seem to observe the price take. When it hits this amount, I'm going to sell the shares, and he does. When he's got a stop loss, they tend to say, well, maybe I should just hold on. Maybe I'll get lucky and I'll bounce back again. And that's why there's stop loss. And then you find yourself going through that as well. So we're terribly affected by things we're not even aware of. And that's, I think, was the beauty of this book. And that was the genius of Kahneman and bringing that to our attention.
Wonderful. Ian Mann, thank you so much. Glad we got you on a good phone line. MD at Gateways Business Consultants. His number one book of all time. Our regular book reviewer, Ian Mann. Let's talk markets.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To Rudy van der Merwe we go, and I can't believe it's the end of the first quarter. But you know what, Rudy? It's the end of the first quarter. The US is up 10% for the year so far, and we're not. It's been a rough first quarter, I think, for us and for most markets around the world, but America wins it by a country mile, I suspect. Earth to Rudy. You see, I was told that Rudy was there, and then Rudy wasn't there anymore. And that was a pity. You know, when you do these build-ups, and unfortunately it happens, you know, in this digital world in which we live, where the person to whom you want to speak is there for a moment, and then they disappear into the digital crevasse that is the internet. But certainly today's markets showed some small gains. I mean, we were up 0.75% or thereabouts. The JSE doing nicely. The market was up about 0.75%. But our performance in the JSE has been nowhere near what the United States has returned. Now, the big question I suppose you've got to ask yourself is as to why the JSE is underperforming. Well, it's to do with all of the stuff we talk about all the time. It's the politics, it's the economy, it is all of the mess that we have in our economy. Just a quick view from you, Rudy van der Merwe. Sorry, we've had connection issues with Ian Mann and then with you this evening. Just give us a quick view on it, please, in terms of this first quarter and the relative performance of the JSE to other big markets around the world.
JSE is having a tough time generally at the moment, Bruce. So our market so far this year is down in the region of 3-odd%, whereas a lot of the developed world is at sort of recordish levels. So there's certainly a lot of that has to do with confidence and I think uncertainty around our political outlook and the impact of continued load shedding and infrastructural
failure,
really. Mm. Yes, so our market is suffering as a result of that and has derated quite materially. Let's hope that changes after we get more certainty from our elections.
Yeah, we certainly do hope so, because the valuations are cheap. I mean, when you look around the world and you look at the amount of money that you're expected to pay for an American share, admittedly, in an economy that is growing and booming and doing all of the things that it is supposed to do, you're paying a very, very high price for that apparent certainty. And I'm sort of channeling Kahneman here. But at the same time, you're paying virtually nothing because there is so much uncertainty in this market. And until our policymakers can get their heads around that fact, I fear that we don't make the progress that logically we should.
No, absolutely true, Bruce. The offshore markets are at this stage have a great deal of good news priced into them. There's a lot of expectation that we'll see significant cuts in interest rates, and all that sort of good news is already reflected in prices. A lot of hopefulness in terms of earnings acceleration from artificial intelligence and so forth. Whereas domestically, everything that can possibly go wrong is reflected in our asset price. Shares are trading, relatively speaking, compared to our other emerging market peers at sort of similar levels that we did in the 1990s when we were largely priced for a civil war. You know, so there's a tremendous amount of bad news in here, and things just have to go slightly better than they are now, and our market could react materially up and still be very cheap.
And that's the great irony of it. And absolutely, everybody would feel better. There'd be more investment. There'd be a greater sense of optimism. Rudy, not a great phone line, but please enjoy your nice long weekend. Sorry to keep you waiting. Rudy Funamara, he, of course, is a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. Mongezi, standing by with Eyewitness News, now just gone 6:30.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
It's that thing. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. Wonderful to be with you on this eve of a long weekend. If you are traveling this evening, please do be careful. And I remind you also of the Genius Podcast series. I saw today, incidentally, that Investec celebrated its 50th birthday. It's amazing, isn't it, in terms of the life cycle of South Africa's truly great global businesses. And it starts out in downtown Johannesburg, and I recall very clearly Stephen Kosseff talking to me about how he would walk down through the streets of downtown Joburg with the founders, Larry Nestat and the other guys, and they would talk, have big ambitions, saying one day we're going to be Goldman Sachs. And they've never become Goldman Sachs, but they've certainly become a very impressive global operator, the creation of not only the banking business, the wealth business, and of course 91, formerly known as Investec Asset Management. And you just look at the way in which the guts and the chutzpah, the cheek and the opportunism that led to their growth, and the expression of a brand via a zebra, just the craziness of it. And if you haven't listened to the episode in the G Car series, going on a road trip this weekend, and if you're not going on a road trip, going on a walk, sitting at home, make time. It really is a story, a great inspirational story, an aspirational story of what is possible from the southern tip of Africa.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
We've been paying tribute this evening to Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist who won a Nobel Prize for economics. He did it by proving that humans, despite our belief that we are rational, are deeply irrational when it comes to economic issues. And I wonder whether or not the decision to stand up and refuse to pay e-tolls was a sensible economic decision. Certainly, a lot of people would defend it as a political decision, say that the government was behaving in an unjust fashion by imposing a ridiculous, expensive road system with its outrageous gantries and ludicrous repayments to foreign companies that had installed these elaborate systems to capture the little tags on what should have gone on your windscreen, and most of you didn't ever bother installing. The system brought down by popular dissent. And today, the official end of the e-tolls program. That's brilliant. Here's the problem, though. The money's been spent and has to be repaid. Kai Sitole is independent political analyst, and he's with us from Johannesburg this evening. And I wonder if it is a rational decision bias. It was an emotional decision. It was a political decision. It was a popular decision. But was it a sensible economic decision? Kai, I'll put your accountant hat on.
Well, good evening to the listeners. I think the complexity here is that obviously when the economics are at play, it definitely wasn't the type of decision that would withstand the economic fundamentals. And when you talk about the economic fundamentals of public policymaking, it's very clear that public infrastructure and public resources have to be funded. And I think the ways in which they can be funded is that you can obviously go for the general taxes. But of course, the resistance by the government towards that was a simple fact that, well, actually, the benefit was going to primarily accrue to you and I who were driving on the roads of Gauteng. So therefore, it did not seem fair, as far as the government was concerned, to have a general tax as the solution to this. So of course, they then went for the user pay model. The primary mistake that they made with the user pay model, besides the question of consultation, was the simple way in which they decided to implement it. And they implemented it in a way that you and I could find a way to resist, and you and I could find a way to say, no, I actually am not interested in this. And I think the most important example that we can use is if you look, for example, at the increase in VAT that we saw a couple of years ago from 14% to 15%. If you had asked anyone if they agreed with that, the answer would have been the same as it is those to say, no, I would prefer that it doesn't happen. But because the government found a way to implement it that didn't give us the latitude or the capacity to resist and withhold the money, we had to live with it. And the e-tolls model was simply very different in the sense that there were so many odd avenues for people to say hell no, and people did say hell no for a better part of a decade.
And we still have to pay for it, though. So somehow, by hook or by crook, or by hook or by crooks in this particular case, we still have to pay the cost. It gets spread more widely because it gets paid across every taxpayer. But it's an unfair thing because, again, not that many people in South Africa pay tax, and they already are taxed to the hilt. And some of that tax money now, in an already strained budget, has to go to pay this bill. You know, whether we want to or not, we're paying for it.
Yes, and I think the interesting development here is that we've moved from the original question of where the South African citizens at large should pay for it through the national fiscus, and the answer was simply no, to the secondary question of whether only those that use the roads and do not have exemptions. Remember, taxis, for example, have had an exemption. That's what the government wanted to put in place so that only the road users would pay. Now we've ended up with a model that says that all the citizens of Gauteng are essentially responsible for this because it has now moved onto the provincial balance sheet. But even that is an incomplete assessment because only 30% of it has moved to the provincial balance sheet. The rest of it, the 70%, has actually then been simply allocated to the national balance sheet because National Treasury is going to pay for it. So the answer here is that what we're now facing is that the citizens of Gauteng are responsible not only for their share of the 70%, which is obviously going to be absorbed by the national fiscus at large, but also then specifically for the 30% share from the provincial budget. The problem, unfortunately, Bruce, is that the provincial budget doesn't have the capacity right now to absorb its share, which is around 13 billion rand based on today's numbers. So it's going to be a very expensive exercise. It's an expensive decision, but it's a decision that's become more expensive the longer it was delayed for a whole decade where the decision wasn't made. It simply started accumulating. And of course, now we've got the 13 billion rand, which is the capital today, and the simple question of the maintenance backlog, which is another 4 billion rand. So we've got an 18 billion rand problem that we've inherited through this gazette.
Yeah, thank you very much, Kaiser Tolle. I mean, you know, you may have objected to it. I was one of the people who had an e-tolls tag. I topped it up and, you know, it pinged every time I went under simply because, I don't know, I didn't want the hassle of not doing it. But there were lots of people who objected. And, yep, you won the day. Was it the rational thing to do? When it comes to choosing wine and you're sitting with the wine list, what is the rational thing to do? With the Daniel Kahneman hat on, Daniel Kahneman died at the age of 90 yesterday, father of, well, one of the fathers, but certainly a very significant father, big contributor to the field of behavioral economics. Can we take behavioral economics and apply it to a wine list? Michael Fridgen standing by. He is the international wine expert at Wine Wizard. More with him in a moment.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Next time you go to a restaurant, do yourself a favor the next day. Not immediately, because it'll ruin your night, but look at the food component of the bill and then see what your drinks cost you. Odds are you will be appalled. And the last time he was here, Michael Fridgen and I, were talking about some great South African wines. And he very kindly, then immediately after the show, gave me a lift to a meeting at a restaurant in Illovo where I picked up the wine list. And I sent him a screenshot of the prices being charged for admittedly wonderful wines. But I thought to myself, these guys are taking the polite word as Mickey, I think. And in your latest column, Michael Fridgen, I see that you are taking on iniquitous wine list prices. Tell me why, what has fueled your outrage?
And I mentioned a wine list of a newly opened restaurant in Stellenbosch where the new style of wine list kind of construction is visible to all. You mention behavioral economics. People walk into a restaurant. Firstly, they want the wines they're familiar with. Secondly, if they're not familiar with them, assume you're in a Greek taverna in Athens, you will definitely not go for the most expensive, and you will certainly never choose the least expensive. And so you have to kind of make your way through the wine list. And what licensed establishments are doing this, they are making the wines you might recognize very expensive, and offering you alternatives that you're unlikely to know much about, but which in fact carry equally high margins. In this particular case, they are 300 to 400% markup. And my point is twofold. One is that there's very little that goes into wine service. The stuff gets delivered weekly by the distributors. Somebody pulls out a cork and they pour you a glass of wine. A huge amount of effort goes into the kitchen, and the wine is subsidizing the food.
The wrong way of doing it. I mean, to my understanding, it's always the way in which it's worked. It doesn't mean it's right, but it's kind of, there seems to be an economic model which people accept in that sort of, in that situation.
Well, we've become accustomed to it, and I had a lot of kind of flack back for that article this week. Not necessarily, in fact, not at all from restaurateurs, but from people who say you're implying that they are profiteering and that it's a very tough game to be in, which I'm sure it is, and that actually they're doing the best they can. And my point is that if they charged the right price for the food, they wouldn't be addicted to the wine list as a way of making up the shortfall.
But if they charged the right price for the food, I don't know if we would go, Michael, because we'd say, oof, that place is outrageous. Have you seen the prices on the food?
That's exactly what someone said to me today. But here's the problem. Here's the problem. Drink drives, especially, say, in the Western Cape, is now being strenuously enforced, as it should be. And more people are drinking less and less when they go out. So what does the restaurant do? It either cranks up the margin so that the one bottle of wine you order instead of the two gives them the revenue they need, or they are going to have to face the difficult truth that they've avoided for years, which is people need to pay for the food. They cannot expect wine drinkers to subsidize their nights out.
I'm getting where your rage is coming from, Michael. You're tired of support of paying for other people's food. And I think that's a reasonable position to take. Now, listen, Michael, help me here, please, because in honor of Daniel Kahneman and in terms of our behavioral psychology, how do we navigate a wine list? You do name this Stellenbosch restaurant. You don't name the restaurant, but you say there's a Rupert and Rothschild Classique on that restaurant wine list at 798 Rand. If you go to a bottle store, you pay less than 200. Seriously, Old Dirt from Villafonte, 800 bucks, less than 200 in the shops. And then you're faced with the choice of paying quite a lot of money for wines you've never heard of. Cottabos Grenache Syrah, 550. Looks like a bargain relative to the others, but you don't know what's in the bottle. And that's the problem, isn't it?
That is the problem. Incidentally, somebody sent me a message today saying that I think it's the Grill House, is charging 400 Rand for Rupert and Rothschild and 500 Rand for Seriously Old Dirt. They seem to be making a living out of it. So either they're charging a better margin on the food, either it's easier to run a steakhouse because you can predict pretty much what you're going to be selling. But either way, it's not necessary always to do this. So my anger isn't necessarily a personal anger. I don't eat out that much. It's about the idea that it's a flawed model, and sooner or later it's going to bite the guys back. The sooner they start to make it realistic, the sooner it will be a better balanced environment in which to dine.
Very quickly, how do I navigate the wine list? Do I go to the middle? Do I go to second from the bottom, which is a very popular strategy, but I was reading the other day that the danger of going to second from the bottom or third from the bottom is those who structure wine lists know that cheapskates of the world go there. And generally, the margins on those cheaper bottles can ironically be greater than the margins on the more expensive bottles. And actually, they make greater profits out of the cheaper bottles than they do out of the more expensive ones. Is that something you've noticed?
It's absolutely true. You are quite correct. And increasingly, once again, in the Western Cape, where there are many foreign visitors, restaurants priced to what would seem reasonable to somebody shopping with dollars, pounds, or euros. So, yes, the answer is firstly, choose the variety that you like. Don't be so adventurous that you're going to order a Grenache if you've no idea what a Grenache looks like. Secondly, in this day and age of readily available information, go straight onto your smartphone, look at the names of the wines on offer, mostly there will be somebody who rates them, talks about them, and tells you what the retail price will be. And on that basis, you can make a semi-informed decision.
The trouble with this is, Michael, and again, those that structure the wine lists know that we succumb to peer pressure. You don't want to be going to your guests because you've invited people out for dinner, because you're a generous kind of guy. And you don't want to be sitting there going, just hold on a second, this wine list is outrageous. Let me just double check a thing or two. Hey, Hassan, come on, you're a... You just quietly pick up offends you least, I suppose, and that's the pitfall and why, up until now at least, it's worked.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
What a dreadful start to the Easter long weekend with that dreadful bus accident near Mokopane. We don't know what caused the bus crash. We don't know if it was driver. We don't know if it was fatigue. We don't know if it was roadworthiness or road conditions. What we do know is that roads are very, very busy at this time of year. We know that the particularly roads to Moria at this time of the year are massively congested. Everybody's trying to get there. It's a massive and important religious and cultural festival at this time of the year. But please, for goodness sake, be careful. And if you've got a choice and you board some public transport that is not great, make a choice. Just say no. Just say no, because, I mean, is it worth it? Not every unroadworthy bus is going to crash, but you do take your life into your own hands sometimes, particularly on some of these long-distance routes where the infrastructure doesn't support necessarily a good outcome.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show, brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSP. Well, one story I am celebrating this evening is that arrogant, repugnant, unrepentant little toad, Sam Bankman-Fried. Remember him, arrested and convicted within a year. I do love swift justice. Sam Bankman-Fried has been sentenced to 25 years in prison. His role in the collapse of his FTX cryptocurrency exchange. A U.S. judge has decided that he's done enormous harm. He stole billions of dollars in customer funds and he made very risky bets. It is probably one of the longest ever prison sentences for a white-collar defendant in the United States. And his collapse from hero to zero has been nothing short of extraordinary. He's 32 years old. 7 counts of fraud and money laundering. He was convicted last year. And the judge pointing out he showed absolutely no remorse. He in a prison uniform. And I suppose saying, you know, I made a series of bad decisions. I was responsible for FTX and it collapses on me. But there's no admission of guilt. Anyway, he's going to jail for an awfully long time. I doubt he'll serve the full 25 years. There's bound to be some sort of arrangement at some point. But it sends such a powerful signal, does it not, that when you are corrupt and you do get found out, that you will be held to justice. Just saw Jacob Zuma today, the man who's making the ANC's life difficult because they didn't take proper action against him when they had the opportunity and let him get out of jail free on his contempt charge. That was a legitimate conviction for refusing to abide by the lawful instructions of the Zondo Commission. Yet every trick was pulled and every rug was pulled and Jacob Zuma was released. Now he's making life hell for them. He's just lost his 6th attempt to get Billy Downer struck off his prosecution for the arms deal conviction. And we know the arms deal conviction, was sound because Shabir Sheikh was convicted on those charges and did go to jail very briefly. But then he too was released to go and play golf on his terminal illness. Terminal illness, my foot. Welcome to The Money Show. Rant over on the eve of this long weekend.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Is Airbnb a thing of the past? Joan Muller is the property editor at the Financial Mail. It should be booming. It should be flying. It should be shooting the lights up. But we hear a lot less about Airbnb, Joan, than we did in the past. What's going on? Now, something has definitely gone awry here. Are we struggling, producers, with the digital connections? Because earlier on, we had a digital connection. I was told that Joan was there, and then Joan wasn't there. Earlier on, we struggled as well. We do seem to have a systems error. But now my producers are retrospectively getting hold of Joan, because unfortunately they can't check whether she's there. It's just, and anyway, perhaps we need to relook at the system. But I would like to be communicated with. So, you know, the waving of hands is lovely, but I really don't know what you're talking about. David Shapiro will join us, I hope, at 7:30 this evening. He's going to be talking about bonds and the bond market. And we are going to be getting a very clear sense of what happens in the bond market. And, yeah, let's pause.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
So why aren't more SMMEs getting access to finance? We hear that talk, that, oh, no, there's lots of money available. No, there's plenty of money available. There's always money available for good ideas. But the biggest complaint we get from anybody who's ever tried to raise finance is there's no finance available. If you remember, Nick Haralambos, the guy who started Nick Harry Socks, was a regular on The Money Show, and he upset lots of you. He was fabulous. I miss him. But he's on to other things now. But Nick would say things like, you know, there's plenty of money available. If you're not getting funding, it's because your idea isn't good enough. And maybe that is true. Or maybe you don't pitch properly. Or maybe you don't formulate your idea into a way that is investable. Just because you think your idea is wonderful and you work very hard and you're exhausted, it doesn't mean that anyone else is going to be willing to risk their capital. Well, the SAB Foundation, for a very, very long time, has been helping entrepreneurs and social innovators to grow their businesses. And it's got a system and a process of how it goes about it. It's got 110 million rand a year. So there's money available. What you've got to do, however, is impress them. Bridget Evans is with us. Bridget is executive director at the SAB Foundation. This perpetual problem of not being able to raise money for SMMEs. What's at the core of the problem here, Bridget? Have I touched on any nerves, any incorrect assumptions, or am I roughly in the ballpark of what's actually going on?
No, I think you're exactly in the ballpark. I think that there is a lot of money available, but there are way too many entrepreneurs that won't be able to access that funding. And so there is a mismatch, you know. So on the one hand, you've got, you know, even like the banks, for example, the banks all made commitments to the government that they would allocate a certain amount of money to investing in SMMEs. And as far as I know, is most of them have really, really struggled to do that. And actually, many of them haven't invested any of that money at all. And so, yeah, my experience, so we, as you said, you know, we've been working with entrepreneurs for a long time. And our programs, they really try and help entrepreneurs in a number of different ways. So it's all the usual things, skills training, access to markets, mentoring, plus some catalytic funding. So we've been doing that for a very long time. And last year we introduced a loan fund because we kept hearing from so many SMMEs that they cannot access loan finance. So, I mean, I'll be honest and put my head on the chopping block here and say, well, we thought, oh, well, you know we can do it better. And we are going to offer affordable interest rates and lend to entrepreneurs. And what we discovered was that it was so difficult.
You schooled, Bridget. Why is it so difficult? Because here you are. You've got a big pool of cash. There are lots of people looking for cash, but there is a chasm between you. What is causing the chasm?
Okay. So just to be clear, we philanthropically, we have no problem, you know, spending that budget every year. And we help over 100 entrepreneurs a year. The challenge becomes when other people give you their money and they want that money back, and you actually then want to lend to these businesses, what we discovered very quickly was that almost every single one of them has no financial records, or such poor financial records that you actually can't, there is no ways you can make an investment decision given the records that they have. Now, these are not they're not necessarily startups. These are businesses, some of them have been operating for 10 years. And the entrepreneur has managed to keep this business afloat during all sorts of tough times that have been thrown at us, but they're still not investable. And the reason is because of this financial record issue. And it is, initially I thought, was it just us? But then I started speaking to multiple other people who, operate in a similar environment to us around investing in SMMEs. Everyone said exactly the same thing. They all have the same challenges.
One doesn't blame. Well, one does blame people because you're asking for public money and you're then complaining that you can't raise public money, but you can't prove what it is you do, how you've done it, and how effective you are at doing it. That's your responsibility as a business owner. It's tough and horrible to say, but here you've got a lot of people who are forced into entrepreneurship because they've got no choice because there aren't any jobs. So they go and make a plan, and actually they're pretty good at what they do. What they're not good at is the boring stuff, and I fully understand this. Oh, my goodness me. There is the amount of clutter and nonsense that you're expected to do each and every single year, and the expense of doing it when you do it properly is prohibitive micro-enterprise. It really is, and frustrating, and it's the part of my life that I hate most is admin. But if you don't do the admin, you're not going to get the money that you need.
Yeah. Well, I think, a lot of entrepreneurs who do have a little bit of disposable income, they outsource it to an accountant. And the problem that we see is the accountants, an accountant, first of all, they don't interpret numbers. So they're not like a financial director that interprets those numbers and is able to make decisions about the future of that company based on those numbers. All they see their job as being is just writing the numbers down. And so it doesn't give the entrepreneur any insight into their business and how it's doing. And so, for the most part, and that's what we would love to see change, is there is clearly a psychological issue associated with numbers. And it's actually something that I'm going to research this year, is really try and get to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
I think that...
No, but it's a fundamental thing here, Bridge. I'm making an assumption here. Your research may or may not back this up. But here's the problem, is we've got a schooling system that's not equipping people even simply for the basic realities of the world. If you ever did do accounting, then maybe you've got a chance of interpreting your own numbers. But there is a huge gap here for accountants to offer a service at a reasonable rate to say, this is all the information you've given us. From the information that you've made available, and this is the picture we've got of your business. This is what this means. This is what this means. So when you go to raise the funding, and we can come with you perhaps as part of the service, we can help the funders understand how we deduced this analysis of your financial performance. Because until the entrepreneur understands that part of their business, they understand how to make the widget that is sold, and they understand how to collect the money, but they don't understand how to report it in a way that is useful to people like yourself who say, I've got a bucket of money to give you if you can convince me that it's a good bet. And without that conviction, you can't.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, First National Bank has been really, they are the biggest bank that lends to SMMEs. And they use bank statements to make their decisions about lending. But, that's not the case with a lot of people. And so at least what they have done is they've understood that this financial record keeping is a big issue, and they're able to make good lending decisions off the back of their bank statements. But that's only the case for people who bank with them, and So, I mean, I completely agree with you. It's very obviously an education issue. And so, but I also think that, you know, financial services is a very alienating thing. You know, as you've quite rightly said, people are not trained in accounting speak. And it's a kind of a language that is very exclusive. And so I came across a tool a little while ago, which is really clever. Basically, it takes out all the accounting jargon and it says, money I owe, who owes me, kind of thing. It uses language like that, money in, money out, whatever. And it allows an entrepreneur, and then what it does is it actually does the proper accounting stuff in the background so that the entrepreneur doesn't have to worry about that stuff. All they have to do is just put in the basic numbers or get anyone in their team to put in those numbers. Yeah. And I think that we need more things like that.
Yeah.
Huh?
No, exactly right. I mean, debits and credits. I mean, the thing is, you get a credit card and a debit card. Then you've got a debit and a credit on your financial statements. And goodness knows whether the two are similar or different, and you have no idea. So you just turn a blind eye because the moment anybody speaks to you in a language that you cannot comprehend, then you just find yourself alienated. And if you're alienated, you can't relate. You want to be able to go into, and I know that this is not the real world, so don't shout at me, but the Dragon's Den type pitch, where you've got four or five very smart people who have seen every trick in the book, who've got money to invest, want to not only see that the people who are presenting to them are good at what they do, but they understand the result of what they do. And so when they ask them a slightly technical question, they want them to be able to deliver an answer specifically to the question, not go around beat about the bush, and because that immediately tells your investor that you don't understand and that you actually are a big financial risk. And until you can do that, you're not going to get the backing. And it's such a wonderfully eye-opening discussion for me this evening, Bridget. It's something I think intuitively I've believed, but it's good to have your experience in this backing it up.
Yeah. I mean, it's an absolutely prolific problem. And it's so sad because, you know, we either have to change the way we assess risk completely, turn it on its head, and I can't see that happening with your traditional financial services, or we have really got to hone in on this issue and try and change this picture, because it's such a tragedy when you think about it. Like entrepreneurs, if they can't grow, they're not going to create jobs. They, you know, and it's kind of, there's a big mismatch between people who've got capital to lend and not being able to lend it because they, you know, the entrepreneur can't give them any financial information that they can use to assess risk, you know?
And here's the problem also, and maybe it's an advantage to the entrepreneur, but if you don't have financial statements or you don't have financial statements that are intelligible, it makes it incredibly difficult for the South African Revenue Service to assess whether or not you owe it any money. And one of the purposes of accounting, of course, is to make sure that there's a check and a balance. And if you are earning money and you are making a profit and you are making profit over a certain level, you're obliged to hand some of that to the government. And I know you don't like it, but it should be precisely what you're doing. And, you know, there's a huge vested interest in government here that, you know, should be coming up with some sort of direction as to how this sector should be operating more professionally.
I totally agree with you. And in fact, I have heard that there are some really important discussions happening in government around this issue. Yeah.
Brilliant. Bridget, thank you so much. A really, really valuable conversation this evening.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
David Shapiro, who is the Chief Global Equity Strategist at Sasfin, standing by for us. He is going to explain in a way that I can understand, because I've had lots of people explain this to me over many years, and I still have palpitations whenever I talk about it. So we'll talk about that in just a second. I can tell you next time on The Money Show, we're going to be talking about how to make money when you're dead. Great businesses make you money while you sleep. Is it possible to make money when you're dead. Well, Wilbur Smith died 3 years ago. There's still books being published in his name, and he's not written them, but they've got his name on the cover. I'll talk to his agent, Kevin Conroy Scott, on how to make money when you're dead next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
David Shapiro, the chief global equity strategist at SASFIN, not talking about equities this evening, interestingly enough, David Shapiro, but bonds and how to invest in them. And I'm so glad that we're going to have this discussion, because I'm eternally perplexed by the price of bonds, the rate of bonds, what goes up when it goes up and what goes down when it goes down, and why that happens and what I should be doing if I was to invest in them. But before we get there, let's go back to the very beginning. Whenever I talk about bonds, I ask for an explanation as to what a bond is. This much I do understand, but you'll explain it better. Explain, please.
Bruce, as you introduced me, I'm an equity analyst or an equity person, and suddenly I'm having to talk about bonds. So we're going to have to take this very, very slowly. I mean, for both you and me, you know, just so that I can get it across clearly and hopefully people will understand. But understand one thing, I am not an expert in this market. But Bruce, a bond's nothing more than a loan, an agreement by the lender, that's us, who's got the money, and lend the money to someone who hasn't got the money or who needs the money. And generally those people, and I'm talking about the broader bond market because it's a massive market. It overshadows the equity market by huge amounts. It's far, far bigger in the global environment or investment environment than the equity market. But, you know, generally you're lending money to either a country or maybe a company, a lot of municipalities, a lot of provinces. So many people, you know, do issue bonds or do require money and go into the market, to the investment market, institutional market, to borrow these funds. So it's nothing more than a loan. And that loan, like every other loan, even if you're lending to your neighbor, to your children, to whoever you do, it normally has a fixed period, you know, you're going to pay it over so long, and also you're going to pay a rate of interest. And I think those are the basic components of it. And that's where all the complications come in afterwards. But I mean, no,
Let's stick with the basics here, David. I mean, America owes $35 trillion. And I'm often asked the question, who does it owe the money to? And my most simple answer is, probably to you, because if you have any kind of retirement fund, retirement funds love bonds. Mm. Retirement funds like to have a portfolio of assets. They're like your equities. They're like a bit of property. They're like a bit of bonds exposure. They're like a bit of cash exposure. And they're very comfortable to lend money, particularly to governments, because governments have, generally speaking, most governments are pretty good at paying their interest and servicing their debt in the long term and ultimately paying it back. So those are the sort of people you want to lend money to. And we live in a world where everybody seems to be, well, most countries seem to be borrowing money. Certainly South Africa has to pay R1 billion a day in interest. So just explain this idea as to why governments do this. And if you want to use the South African budget as a point of reference, it's probably a good one.
Yeah, exactly. What they do is they borrow money to balance their budget, because most countries spend more than they earn. In other words, they're spending more on health, on education, on all those elements that they need, in our case, on social grants, than they're getting in income tax. What is it? How does a country earn its money? It's generally on taxation, whether it's personal income tax, whether it's, you know, fuel levies, whether it's VAT, whatever it is. It gets its money through taxes, but broadly those taxes never cover the expenditure. So how do they make up that difference? They borrow money and they go to the institutional market. Those funds that you were mentioning, your pension fund, provident funds, and various other investors, and they borrow money for them. From them. Now, what's important, and this is where you come to South Africa, the big discussion comes around whether the country, number one, can afford to borrow more and at what rate, and also whether it will pay back that amount of money. And it's very important politically to maintain that balance. And that's why we have our very conservative finance minister, who explains this when he presents the budget, how much they might need to borrow in order to balance their budget. But it's one of those factors, one of the many factors that can influence the rate at which you can borrow money. And also the concern is investors will look and say, listen, can this government pay us back? You know, if not, we're going to demand a higher interest rate. So we're getting into the kind of issues that affect the bond market all the time. But I think broadly, government spend to balance the budget. And, you know, no one collects more. It's very seldom that you get a country actually balancing its budget in any year and not having to go into the market to borrow more funds.
Okay. So here, I mean, and also we assume that governments are good for it. However, you've only got to look at a country like Argentina, which not once, not twice, but I think probably three times in the last 30 or 40 years has not been able to pay its debts. And so people, it restructures and it re-engineers and replans and then goes out and says, we'd like more money. And each time it goes, we want more money, it gets charged more. So a higher interest rate to borrow that money. And occasionally things go awry in that economy for many, many reasons. And it fails to pay back. It does something called a default. And that means that whoever lent it money, your pension fund, my pension fund, whoever lent it money, then has a problem because the debt is not repaid.
Exactly. And that when it's not repaid, I think broadly that's why you do have funds like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank who sometimes come and bail out nations, but it still puts an additional burden on those nations to pay back the fund. But what happens, Bruce, and this is important, and I mean, I don't want to go off on a tangent. When you default or can't pay back, what happens is it affects your currency. And broadly, you know, your currency normally depreciates quite significantly. And that's always a risk that you face when going into markets or you face as an investor, as somebody who lends money. You know, for example, if you were to come into the South African bond market years ago and you would have bought South African bonds, you know, 10-year, 20-year, 30-year, and over time, and these are the South African bonds, these are rand-denominated bonds, over time, because of the depreciation of the rand, the money that you get out at the end is not the money you put in, you know, if you put dollars in. So all I'm trying to illustrate is that there are risks. And the longer the time that you lend the money to a country or to anybody, the more those risks accumulate. And therefore, in order to compensate that, you either, you know, you are going to want a higher rate of return. You know, you're going to ensure that the risks that you are taking are compensated in terms of much higher yields. So I think those are, when we talk about bonds, there's no such thing as a risk-free bond or a AAA bond. You know, they might be rates and such, but every bond, every loan out there has got some kind of risk attached. So, you know, you might not say so in terms of America and that because it's such a strong economy, but broadly, it's not, you know, when you go into the bond market, it's not always risk-free, even though those risks might be dramatically reduced, you know, depending on the level of the borrower, of the stability of the borrower. But Bruce, that's, you know, these are issues that one has to consider. People tend to reckon that the equity market is high risk, but I promise you, bond markets are equally high risk. And I'm coming back to the, you know, where we must bring this in is that when you said, I don't know, rates go up, rates go down, the values go up and the values go down. So, to try and illustrate that, if I can, remember a few years ago, not even 2-3 years ago, interest rates in the United States were 1%. And I think I'm exaggerating. I think they were lower than 1%. So if you bought a 10-year sovereign bond or U.S. Treasury 10 years. In other words, that's the duration of your loan at 1%. And suddenly rates go up to 4%. That has major ramifications, because if you're only getting 1%, let's call it on $1,000 that you put in, what are you getting? $10 return. Suddenly, people today who are buying bonds at 4% are getting $40. That means they're getting four times more than you are. So if you want to, and I hope this explains it to you, but if you want to now sell that bond that you bought at 1%, you're not going to get your nominal value back, your $1,000. You're only going to get $250 back, because 4% on $250 will give you what your bond was giving you, $10. So those are the kind of movements.
This is where I get lost, David. Okay, now we're going to have to go back to baby steps once again. Let's say, for example, I want to lend the South African government. I don't want to lend the South African government money, but I want 10% of my money. There are not many places I can get 10% of my money, but I can buy a government bond. I can invest in something called the R186 government bond. Right. And I go into the bond market and I say, I would like to take 10,000 Rand and invest it into the R186 government bond. And today, I lock in a yield of 10.188%. That's a good yield. That's a good return.
Okay.
In 12 months' time,
I
want to sell it. What happens?
In fact, that 186, probably its coupon was 8% when it was originally issued, but we won't go. We're talking about the current level. And it's important to understand that, Bruce, because I would rather like the 186, I can't remember the exact coupon, but it was issued some time ago, and it's probably at a yield of about 8%. Okay. So
current yield, 9.11. Current yield, 9.11, David. That's the current yield.
Okay. There you are. Right. So you put 1,000 Rand in, and you're going to get 9.11% per annum. I think it's split into two. They play half yearly. But for ease of reference, we'll say you're going to get 9.1%. Right. So as long as you hold that bond until maturity, which is about 8 years' time, I think, let's call it 10 years or 8 years, I can't remember the exact expiry date, you will get back your 1,000 Rand. The government will pay you. And along your journey over those next few years, you will get 9.1% return per annum, which comes
regardless
to,
Rand something. Mm. Yeah, regardless of what happens to the floating interest rate. Interest rates then fall to 4.5%. You have lent money. You've got a contract which says you will pay me for the duration of this investment. I'm committing it to you for 8 or 9 years. Every year you've got to pay me 9.11%. We agree on that no matter what happens. If it goes up to 15%, bad luck. I still get 9%. If it falls to 4.5%, I still get 9%. I've agreed to this contract.
Yes. But along the way, that bond will price itself according to the prevailing interest rates at the time. So over those 8 years, rates will change literally on a day-to-day basis, depending on so many factors. Inflation rate, what's happening in the world, worries about South Africa repaying its debt, worries about global debt. There's so many factors that affect the bond market on a day-to-day basis, the interest rates. So along the way, the bond traders will price the bond according to prevailing conditions. And that can take you through a very tricky ride, as you watch the value of your bond go up and go down and go up and go down. So that's where it causes a lot of confusion with people who are, not really familiar with the bond market. But it prices daily and it can go up or down accordingly. But as you say, if you just stick the journey, if you stay with it right until maturity, you will get your money back, the full amount of your money back, and monthly you will get that your fixed rate of interest.
So it's very important to understand that there are two different price points when it comes to investing in a bond. There is the price of the bond, the asset itself, like a share, I suppose. There's that thing's got a price, but it's also then got effectively a dividend, if we were trying to compare it to shares, which I understand better than I do bonds. You've got a share, which is the bond, which goes up and down in value. You've then got an interest payment, which is like a dividend. And that is, but this time it's a fixed dividend over a period of time.
Right, exactly. Same. But it's a massive market. So you're dead right. You know, that's exactly what it is. Just one thing about bonds, they are taxable. It's fully taxable. It's interest. And it's one differentiating point. It depends on the vehicle in which you hold the bond. Your pension fund won't pay it. You know, you won't pay it. But as an individual, if you do go into the bond market, it's not, you know, the only difference is not like a dividend which pays 20% tax. You pay full tax, which is depends on your rate. So you have to factor that in as well. And Bruce, I think we're coming to a bonds, I think, in the South African market at the moment, the ones that you mentioned, and even if you go a little longer to the various bonds, they're very attractive. You can get over 10%. Some of them that are longer duration, you know, going up to 20 years or something, you can get you know, closer to 10, 11% if you want to stick it out. So there are very, very attractive entry points at the moment for people who want to get that fixed return. Of course, the risks are that, number one, you will be fully taxed on the interest that you receive. And secondly, you've got the depreciation of money. You know, this is not like an equity. If you lend 10,000 Rand or something, you get back 10,000 Rand. You get back exactly the amount, which over years might have lost some of its purchasing power. But these are all the factors that you have to consider, you know, when you look at this market, when you go into the market. Can be very, you know, there are a lot of factors. But bond traders trade all the time. They're fully, you know, they go all the time. I mean, pension funds, provident funds, all of these institutions that trade in these instruments are very, very active, playing what you call the yield curves. You know, as rates change, so they change their positions in the market. And we don't want to bring in inflation-linked bonds because it's just going to complicate everybody. So there are inflation-linked bonds which can sometimes protect you against some of the inflationary elements of you know of money.
Okay, so at the moment, bonds have delivered terrible returns. You've got a great yield on your bonds, but the price of bonds has fallen because the yield has risen. Is that a correct assumption?
Right. Absolutely right. Yeah. Yeah. But we come back to the same factor that you brought in. If you stay with your bond, you know, they've risen or the bond values have fallen only because of the current rates have gone up. But for those who bought it at the original price, you will get your full money back. You know, that's one comfort. But, you know, it might not be as much as you wanted in the, you know, the value might not be as much as you could have made. But Bruce, I hope people who listen to this, you know, got some kind of understanding of the risks involved and how that market operates. But it can be very, you know, can be very, very complicated. And when you listen to bond traders, believe me, we equity traders talk in Janet and Jill type language compared with them. So,
David Shapiro, you have certainly brought light to the murk, and I thank you very much indeed. And the murk, not an M-E-R-C, but an M-U-R-K, and I wish you a wonderful long weekend. Thank you for sharing your understanding and your wisdom in a way that we can understand. David Shapiro is the man we know as a stockbroker, as a man whose expertise lies in equities, but he does understand broad markets and investments, and he has explained it to us, I think, better than anyone else who's ever tried to explain this to my thick skull. Thank you, David Shapiro from SASFIN.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield was brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you award-winning trade and working capital funding solutions to unlock the full potential of your business story. APSA is a registered FSP.